Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, I'd like to welcome to our show, joining us from the UK, is Nick Jenkel, who is an author, futurist, transformation catalyst, and practical philosopher who develops original thinking and powerful tools to ensure that individuals, leaders, and organizations across the planet can thrive in a period of intense challenge. His latest book, Spiritual Atheist, has been a number one new release on Amazon for 5 weeks straight, and is a bold and unique book for the digital age, seeking to provide people with a life and leadership philosophy that has the power to solve the problems we all face in the areas of happiness, health, and relationships, right through to business, leadership, and politics. Nick has advised Number 10 Downing Street, Microsoft, and WWF, and has taught at Yale University and Oxford University. He received a triple first degree, equivalent to summa cum laude, from Cambridge University in medicine and the history and philosophy of science. You can find out more by visiting Nick's website, which is switchonnow.com, and I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Nick to the show. Good day, sir.
Oh, hello. What a lovely welcome.
I'm really happy to have you with me today. Your book is very thought-provoking. There were many times that I would read through one particular chapter, then sit with it, then have to go back and read it again because,
me too.
I like that kind of thing. It's books like yours that help people, shake up their beliefs and in turn shake up their life, really.
Yeah, I mean the two are totally connected. We can't think the same thoughts and expect to have a different life.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to start with the idea that you call this book a philosophical memoir. You basically inserted your life experience in the chapters. So would you mind letting us know, why you chose, to, in a way, insert yourself, so to speak, into the book, and why did you do that?
Well, it's a great question. It wasn't an easy choice to make, or rather, it was kind of chosen for me, and then I spent many hours thinking about not doing that. So I'm going to back up and tell you a little bit about how it came to me, the book. I was actually at a dinner party for some Israeli soldiers. Oh, excuse me. I was at a dinner party for some Israeli soldiers who were getting some quite intense transformational healing. And I was put next to a captain in the Israeli army. And he was very, very religious in a traditional Jewish sense. And he said, what do you do? And I tried to explain a little bit about what I do. And he could not get his head around the idea that I was a profoundly spiritual man, but I was also totally atheistic and didn't believe in God. Like, it just didn't make any sense to him. He couldn't conceive of that reality. And as I told him a bit about my journey to get to that point, I don't know what happened, like some kind of inner alchemy occurred. And by the time I got my Uber ride back home to my home, I had sketched out 10 out of the 11 final chapters are in the book and haven't changed since that moment. And I was actually in the middle of writing another book at the time. So this wasn't a book that I wanted to write. It wasn't that I was sitting there thinking, oh, what should I write now? It just seemed to come through me in a very profound way. So I put aside this other book. And the reason it has my journey in it is it some strange twist of my fate is that I've kind of gone through a lot of the big areas of modern atheistic life and intellectual life. And each time I went through one, I was still found I wasn't happy, I wasn't thriving, I wasn't truly in love with myself or in love with my life. So it just seemed like if writing the book from a semi-autobiographical nature, it's not just about my life, it's just little bits of it to sort of open up conversations about bigger intellectual thoughts. It just seemed like it would be helpful for people to realize this is not something that you, philosophy doesn't have to be something you do at university. It's something you do through living life, as long as you are taking time to reflect on what's going on. So that was really the reason, was to sort of bring the philosophy into life and make it
well, practical. It's actually the those personal stories, I think, that bring home the ideas that you convey in the book. I mean, it personalizes it. It gives, even though people may not have experienced the same kind of struggle, they can at least identify with some of the feelings, some of the things, you know, the challenges, you know, in their life. And so, in a way, I feel that, you know, by putting that in there, you give people a bridge between the ideas and their life, you know, and ways that they can put it into action.
I hope so. Although it's actually interesting because I had a couple of early reviews of a draft version from some professional reviewers, and I got some pretty snarky comments. So both reviews are very positive in a sort of really powerful ideas, you know, very, you know, did a lot of work to sort of bring all these big ideas together. But both reviewers had found my personal story, so it triggered them somehow. It was around the time of, you know, a lot of this social justice conversations around being entitled. And there's a part of my journey that's absolutely entitled. So I think that kind of triggered some people. So it was almost very painful actually to write it with my own personal experience. Because though I've had lots of suffering and pain, as most of us have, I've also had lots of what most people think of as success. And actually the part of the book is to say, you think this is success. I had what we think of as success.
Right.
And it wasn't really anything that I wanted. It wasn't really what I wanted. And that's part of the book, is to show that you can have everything in this material world, education, great degrees, great client stuff, whatever it is you think you want, and it's still not enough. And that was really important part of my journey. So writing from a personal point of view is the first time I've ever done it. And it's definitely easier to write as a disembodied philosophical thinker.
Right.
Because there's nothing to argue with, right? You can argue with the ideas, but you can't argue with the person.
Right. I just have admiration for people who put their life out there, you know, for scrutiny or, you know, to be examined, you know, and
exactly,
you know, when you said, you know, that they may have been triggered, my guess is that, you know, you did, you know, some of what you wrote probably did trigger things in themselves that they really didn't want to look at, you know, I mean, it kind of brings it to the forefront, and but that's a good thing, you know, so I would view those overall reviews perfect. Perfect for meeting their goal.
Oh, definitely. So when I do I did a lot of keynote speeches, and usually one of my first things I say is, I'm not here to have a good time, and then you go home going, that was nice. I'm here to provoke you to get change to happen in your body and your mind as this talk is happening. And if I'm just paid to be funny and charming, it won't happen. And so I did actually, from these reviews and just some more reflection, I did add some stuff into the introduction just around, you know, buyer beware. This may provoke you, you know, go with it, enjoy it, look at it, look at why it's provoking you, you know. And it was good.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, and quite honestly, the many of the areas that you bring up in the book are issues that really confront not only the individual, but also communities, countries, and globally. So, I mean, and there are issues that need awareness, you know, brought to the forefront. So, you know, in that sense, it's it helps on many different levels. So, now the book is Spiritual Atheist. So, you're an atheist. Would you share with the listeners how you adopted to or kind of maybe embraced the atheist perspective?
So atheism came to me predominantly through my father, but also through just the culture of the UK, really. I mean, it's interesting for Americans, the UK is extremely atheistic. It's like kind of take all the atheists of New York and San Francisco and, you know, a few other places in the US and then boil them down and you'll get this kind of super distilled atheistic, anti-spiritual, anti-New Age, anti sort of emotionality really in the UK. So I was surrounded by that and I was 15 years old and I'd had a bar mitzvah as a good Jewish boy. And I was then in this sort of slightly more advanced class at the religion school. And they asked us to do run a whole service, Saturday morning service. So it was like 10 or 12 of us. And they asked me to do a sermon. I don't know, you know, why they asked me. I don't think I was particularly gifted at speaking at the time, although I spoke a lot at people. I'm not sure I was a gifted speaker, but I took it very seriously. And so I went off and started thinking, you know, what is God to me in religion? And who is this? Who am I? And, you know, and I read some Freud and I read some Marx and influenced by my father. And my father didn't go to the synagogue. He didn't live near me at the time. He's very anti me going to synagogue. And I ended up writing a sermon that was really precociously, arrogantly critical of religion. But within that process of writing it, I realized I was an atheist. And I realized that religion, in the sense that all I knew what it was, didn't have the answers I was looking for how to relieve the pain of being a teenage, overweight teenage, lovelorn, young gentleman. So that's when the atheism came into my life.
Yeah, it's that's such a young age. I think to have that. But as you described the UK environment, that's something I'm not familiar with. So in the US, you would people tend to have their that socialization and religious doctrination, kind of at its peak, in the early teens and that kind of thing. So now the book is Spiritual Atheism. So what would you describe as the life philosophy or the bios of spiritual atheism?
So for me, spiritual atheism is really a posh way of saying spiritual, not religious, but with some sort of philosophical and scientific grounding, which is really the bit that I wanted to go and find. Because it's easy to tick a box on Facebook and say, what are you? I'm spiritual, not religious. Great. What does that actually mean? And more importantly, how are we going to live our lives from this three words? So that's what I went to do. And originally the book was going to be called The Atheism Breakthrough. Like, I was an atheist. Then I broke through atheism, and then I was found. And but I realized there was a bigger idea in how you take atheism, change it. And so I distinguish between materialist atheism, which is atheism that's then become extended to into a very scientific way, and saying basically nothing that you can't measure and using the scientific method exists. And that means you can prove that atoms exist, and you can prove that gravity exists, and that's all there is, and there's nothing else, and everything else in the universe is just that. It's all empty, and there's dark matter and antimatter and whatever, but there's no God, there's no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no love, because you can't measure them. And I thought, well, that doesn't make sense to me, even though I'm an atheist. So I thought, well, maybe I could sort of change this idea of atheism and create a new type of atheism, which still says, absolutely, there is no God, in terms of a personal God that speaks to you in a from another entity. There's no priest or that has a special relationship to this God, and there's no text that has some revealed sense of this usually patriarchal voice. So you don't have any of that stuff, but you don't then throw out the baby with the bathwater and then say, well, that doesn't mean love doesn't exist, and that doesn't mean purpose doesn't exist, and that doesn't mean peace and joy and connection don't exist. So for me, in summary, spiritual atheism is the realization that there are two parts to us, and there's two parts to the universe. There's a materialist part, which you can measure with science, and we know that really well. And then there's this spiritual part, which we experience as consciousness. It's what happens inside us. And actually, science is really badly designed to understand it and doesn't really try and understand it. And anytime it tries to understand it, it gets lost. But it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means it's really important. And so spiritual atheism is saying, listen, matter is not more important than consciousness, but neither is consciousness more important than matter. They are both complementary ways of knowing one reality. So it's dualistic in the sense that there's two aspects to all things and to all parts of us. That's what I'm feeling, and there's also my physical body that's doing some feeling. But it doesn't mean one or other is more important, and that's really, really key, because a lot of the New Age teachers will say, well, reality doesn't exist, it's an illusion, and all there is pure consciousness. And I say, well, the starving children in Yemen and the abused children in Chicago, for me, they're really real. That's really, really real stuff. I don't want to look at that as an illusion and pretend it's not there. So it's really important to me that this understanding of spiritual atheism is saying both of these strands or streams of information and knowledge and experience are vital.
Yeah, the idea that the materialistic atheist, in the scientific approach and being able to quantify and measure and replicate, that particular aspect doesn't seem, in a scientific method, doesn't seem the approach to be able to apply to the spiritual atheist aspect, that consciousness, the emotion, that spiritual aspect. So it seems that just inherently there isn't the method for knowing or verifying knowledge from both of those components, that the way to measure it is just has to be different because they're so intrinsically different from each other.
Absolutely. And actually, that part of the book came as I wrote it. So I knew that I was holding these two seeming opposites within me, the spiritual life and my scientific life. And I knew I was making decisions from both, data as well as my intuition and my sense of things. But when I really got back to remembering the history of science and the history of the spiritual traditions, it became so clear to me that these two aspects are different, a philosopher might say, ontic realities or epistemological realities, and therefore they need different tools to measure them. And the mistake comes when we try and use the inner gaze, like meditation or contemplation or ecstatic movement, to try and understand atoms. It's not very helpful. Or we use the outer gaze, you know, the microscopes and telescopes, to try and understand, you know, how to help someone feel at peace. Again, not very helpful. And that's where I think we've got caught up in the world at the moment, is we're trying to use, you know, the materialists are trying to use the telescope and the microscope to tell us we don't have an interior life, not really. And then some other people are saying, well, let's use, you know, revelation from God to define our political choices and things that science are better at understanding. And the key is not to get caught in either one. It's to go, I need both of these every moment. And I really mean that. You know, if you're listening to this right now, every moment you have these two streams of information coming into yourself, into your heart and mind. You have sense data, you have scientific data, you have information about immunizations, about what food to eat, about the energy in your cola drink, the data from last month's sales figures, etc. And then you also have this other stream of data coming in from your sense, your sensations inside you, this interoceptive, what people call felt sense or interoception, that includes information from your gut and your heart, right up into your brain, which seems to have a kind of what I would call a non-local capacity to it. It doesn't just get, we have information within us that isn't limited necessarily to what's in our brain. And that's a bit like, whoa, for me as a former scientist and a lot of other people.
Yeah. So now, when I was reading the book, it seemed that there was a pivotal time, an experience that you had that kind of highlighted that spiritual consciousness aspect, and that was a trip to India. Can you maybe explain, you know, just let the readers know about that and kind of the impact that it had on you?
Yes, I have to apologize for the cliched nature of it being in India. But there was something about India that does bring it out of one. And that's as the Beatles found out. There's kind of like a two-piece to this story. The reason I was in India was because I was I'd been running a fast-growing creative agency type thing in London. I've been traveling and growing, and I had lots of staff, and it all kind of melted down, and I had a burnout and a breakdown, and relationship fell apart. I just was like on the floor. And in the months after that, I took some time. I went around the world, ended up in India with a guy who was my business partner at the time, a new business partner, working on these new kind of spiritual technologies and empowerment technologies. And I got fully transformed into a different experience of life. And it's something, what happened, best way to describe it, it's very hard, always very hard to describe what are intense experiences to anyone else. But I'll try and give you a sense of what it did to me. I went from having a sort of knowledge or a verbal understanding that maybe we are all one with everything. Maybe there's this mystical experience. Maybe there's continuity between me and you and me and the table. But during this experience in India, I went from sort of knowing it cognitively to being absolutely sure of it in my entire gut, mind, brain, hands, like all my cells went, wow, okay, this is it. This is the truth, the abiding truth, the only truth that can't be fully disrupted or just deconstructed is that we are all one. And I guess 15 years since then, I'm still unpacking that and reorganizing my entire life around that, because it's such a profoundly different understanding of life to what we get taught, which is actually we're all separate and we're all alone and, you know, we should compete with each other. And it's so profoundly different that it takes many years to restructure one's life, one's career, one's love life, one's parenting, health choices around this reality.
Yeah, that is, I mean, that's a major shift. I mean, you know, we just, as the human experience, we're not, I mean, that may be tied in some, you know, some religious kind of perspective in a way. But I mean, there's the, like you say, that cognitive aspect versus the inner knowing or the experiencing of that. And once, to me, it seems once you experience this, you know, either the connection or you have some kind of experience that defies, you know, your defies convention or everything that you've been taught. You know, one of the things that I've noticed throughout the years I've had the show is that quite often it is that personal experience that gets scientists to shift their paradigm from that scientific method to, if not, you know, integrating the two, then at least open to the realization that there's something more, even though they may not be able to identify it at the time. But it's that personal experience that seems to be the key to opening up one to other possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, it's so huge. There's nothing, I mean, there is no bigger experience than it that I've ever had or could possibly understand that anyone could have, to be honest with you. It's so shattering of one's belief systems, one's feelings, one's emotions and moods. But as you say, and you know, as your, the name of your show is about, is then the challenge becomes, okay, I've had this big life-changing experience. And my heart feels expanded. My sense of freedom feels more capacious. Now what? How do I make that? What do I do with that in my life? And this is really a very challenging thing. And so in my first book, actually, called Switch On, I say at one point, spiritual enlightenment is not the end of the journey of seeking. It's the sort of beginning, really. It's the gateway through one which one walks to then work out, okay, now how do I bring this sense of love and connection and compassion into everything, and particularly into a world that's not really designed around those values or emotions. And this is where, actually, funny enough, being a religious person might make profound spirituality actually easier. And over many years, as I've softened my atheistic edges and less sort of just against religious people, just out of principle, I have actually found myself really connecting with a lot of religious people, even if they don't speak in the way I speak, don't understand necessarily what I'm talking about. I can feel their heart is open, and that's just that's just a thing, right? And that's really powerful. But if you live in the normal materialist world, you know, if you work at Google or you know, work in a company, and there is a distinction between church and state, it's really hard to bring that sense of connection and love into the boardroom, into your lunch break. It's challenging.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to being an atheist, a spiritual atheist, what is your perspective on, like, the afterlife? Or and even maybe that oneness experience is it's a demonstration of, you know, a higher source or a power that is kind of not overseen, but something that is holding that togetherness together, that connectedness together.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. I'll answer the second one first, because that's actually much easier for me.
Okay.
So I don't think of the universe this as a higher being, because I think as soon as I use the word higher, I feel like I'm in religion land.
Right.
So I think of it more as a complex, alive, adaptive, dynamic system that includes everything. I will be honest, I do talk to it as if it's, you know, in a dialogue.
Right.
But I talk to it knowing it's a metaphor rather than necessarily real. And I also know that I'm part of it. So I'm not talking to it saying, you know, help me. out and make me rich. I'm talking to the whole, the wholeness, the everythingness, in a sense of getting guidance about how to contribute better to the world around me. So that's how I think of the sort of complexity of it. I remember the author Philip K. Dick, who wrote a lot of those futurist books, you know, Minority Report, that movie,
right.
Sci-fi. He used this wonderful term called VALIS, Vast Active Living Intelligence System. But he also called it Zebra as a kind of way of reminding ourselves that as soon as we name it, it's not it. We've lost it again.
Right.
So for me, it's more of a feeling of presence. Maybe that's a better way of describing it. It's a feeling of presence within me. But it's not a God's presence. It's a presence of the source of life itself. It's within all of
right.
us. So that's that bit. So far, so easy, relatively, because the next question is takes me into what I will call my speculation and conjecture department. And what I mean by that is I teach a lot of people all over the world, and I teach them essentially this spiritual atheist philosophy, but more importantly, I teach them a methodology that sort of sits on top of it. So if you think of spiritual atheism as an operating system, and then I have some apps, which is what I run my business with. And the apps are leadership programs and personal development programs and keynote speeches and the books. They're all apps that work on the operating system. And nowhere in any of that operating system or the app world that I create do we talk about anything like past lives, future lives, reincarnation, et cetera. So I make a very clear point to say to my clients and my participants, we don't need to have answers to those questions to thrive in our life and to have a deeply spiritual life. And so actually I refuse to talk about it on stage. But I say to people, if you want to go out for dinner after and I conjecture and speculate, absolutely. But the reason I don't talk about it is I don't want anyone who's listening thinking that I'm saying that you have to have a belief about the afterlife in order to be a spiritual being. I don't think you do. I think it can be part of the mystery. And I guess we'll all find out. That said, I do have a sense for me that I will return. Well, this is really hard to talk about because our language is so creates separation.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to say I'll return to the great stream of energy. But of course, I already am in it. I am part of it already all the time. So it's not so much our return as if I've been away. But I guess my form in this materialist world will dissolve quite literally as, you know, the bacteria and the worms get me or the fire. And my energetic consciousness will rejoin the great vast stream of life. Actually, it brings to mind this wonderful saying by one of the Sufi poets. Al-Ghazali, who said, the happiness of the drop is to die in the river. And I think he meant that both the experience of enlightenment and the experience of death, because obviously death, enlightenment is a mini death. And so I think I will rejoin that stream, whether I have any memories from this particular life experience that I'm having now. I don't know, no idea. I think that some of the research on reincarnation is compelling, that it could well be happening. I don't think it would ever happen in the neat way of thinking my entire consciousness will pop up in another entire consciousness. That doesn't make sense to me. Maybe bits of my memories and bits of my emotional patterning and my habitual patterning might show up in another entity. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It's almost like a plasticine. You have plasticine in America? Double checking. Some cultural translation.
I've not. Yeah.
Play-Doh.
No, I don't.
Play-Doh.
Oh, so, Play-Doh. Oh yes. Okay. There we
same
go. Uh-huh. Yes.
And my wife's American, so I have to translate into American all the time. So imagine we've got some Play-Doh, and I'm playing with the yellow bits, and that's me, and you're playing with the blue bits, and that's you, and then we put it all back in the pot. You know, a bit of the yellow and a bit of the blue might end up in another,
right?
You know, sculpture, but all the yellow won't show up in another sculpture. because I think it rejoins the whole. So that's my sense. That said, my wife, who I love and trust and believe, who has helped me co-develop a lot of our tools and our apps, if you like, fundamentally believes she has dialogues with former entities. And I totally get that from her. I just, that doesn't quite make sense from me. So what we've come down to is we say to people, look, you can have intuition or sources of intuitive guidance, and you need them to make your life work. Whether you think of them as spirit guides or past lives or your great grandma, that's one way of thinking. I personally think that's more of a metaphor. Doesn't really matter the nature of where that information comes from, as long as we actually learn to listen to it. That's the important bit.
Yeah, very much so. Well,
so that's kind of like a long way around saying I have no idea.
No, I understand. No, but it was good because, you know, in that answer you provided, you know, an answer to that connectedness and then also, you know, letting us know about your wife's, you know, perspective, you know, and that, you know, in that, you know, I'm sure you both are very convinced or are very assured of, you know, your beliefs, you know, or in some cases your openness and willingness to say, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure, you know, this isn't, you know, so, and I think, you know, that's important, you know, for the listeners to think about. Sometimes, first of all, it's okay to say, I don't know, you know, and one should not be judged by that as well as one who feels that they most certainly know, you know, the answers, you know, but also that sometimes it's not really important to this life experience to necessarily have those answers. I mean, you know, we don't have to have the answer for everything.
It's really, really important that. And in fact, it's a good moment to talk about these two modes of being I talk a lot about in my work, between what I call control mode and create mode. And some people would say that might be your ego and your essence, but I don't fit them exactly onto that distinction. But when we want to know something rather than be it, we want to know it, it's usually a sign that this control mode, this sort of egoic protective part of us, wants to take hold of something and make it certain and sure and part of living a profoundly mystical life is to understand that the heart of mysticism is a mystery. In other words, our little minds in this reality will never fully understand the enormity of the whole. It's almost like we've got a 360 degree view, and our little mind in this human experience can only see 3 degrees of that. That's enough. It's enough to get a sense of the whole, of the mystery of life, of spiritual enlightenment, definitely enough. But we can't ever get our arms around it because it's bigger than us. And so it's a category error to ever think that us as an individual identity can ever capture the entirety of this complex,
right,
adaptive, harmonious symphony. It's like the violin can't capture the orchestra. It's impossible. So you should always watch out for trying to have emphatic, like, I know we get reincarnated. So it's usually a sign that we're probably blocked in some ways and not listening.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to take a quick break here, Nick, and invite anyone who's listening, if you'd like to call in and ask any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to post them. And then when we come back from break, Nick, I'd like to talk about how spiritual atheism fits into today's environment, the digital age that we're experiencing, okay?
Right, sounds beautiful.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my special guest, joining us from the UK, is Nick Jenkel, and we've been talking about his new book, Spiritual Atheist, A Quest to Unite Science and Wisdom into a Radical New Philosophy to Thrive in the Digital Age. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is switchonnow.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back. Nick?
Great.
Great. So, you know, as the subtitle of your book indicates, you know, this new philosophy for the digital age. First of all, how would you describe the digital age? There were a few things when I was reading your book that I hadn't even considered as a part of that age.
So, yeah, I mean, I look at it more as of a kind of epoch, an era. And of course, digital technology is one crucial part of it, but there's two other really important facets or factors. And these three things I call a triple threat, in a sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek homage to Hollywood, where a triple threat is someone who can sing, act, and dance. So for me, the triple threat that makes this age different from all others is, one, what we could call exponential technologies. So these are technologies like the one we're using here to record and distribute in the same moment this podcast without being a part of a media company in New York. So that's an exponential technology. It allows us to do things and grow things very quickly. It could be Snapchat, it could be WeChat, it could be WhatsApp, it could be AI and robots and all these things. So these are exponential technologies. So that's one part of this digital age, the most obvious part. But there are two other really important parts. The second one is a massive tidal change in culture, in society. And the way I could best describe it is, if you were born after the fall of communism in the late 80s, early 90s, then you have a profoundly different view of life and needs and wants and desires and ambitions than someone born at the end of the Second World War. And that's changing a lot about society that we haven't fully understood yet. So people talk about millennials, different from baby boomers. Then we've got Gen Z. So my two kids, they have grown up with on-demand media as their primary form of media. They've grown up with supermarket deliveries as their primary form of getting produce. And that's very different from the rest of the world. And you can see some of the things around the Me Too movement and stuff like that is part of this new cultural horizon. And then the third part, which is actually probably more important than either of them, actually definitely more important than either of them, is what I call the stressed world. And what by that I mean is, we are facing what are no less than existential risks to our species, and they're all kind of hitting us at the same time. So we've got air pollution killing millions. We've got the off a cliff fall in biodiversity worldwide that could literally just wipe everyone out. because now we need to, you know, we're part of a complex food system. We've got climate change, and you know, obviously the fires in California recently, right through to the droughts in the Middle East, which is really one of the main drivers of the Syrian war, which has then had an implication for everything in the rest of the world. So these existential risks are combining with this cultural shift, which is combining with this digital exponential technologies to create just a kind of massive realignment and redesign of everything we know and everything we will know. And they haven't even really hit us yet. You know, AI isn't really here. Climate change isn't really here. You know, we're seeing the signs, but they're not really here yet. And so this makes the next sort of 50 years fundamentally different from the previous, you know, 5,000. And a little phrase I've been using recently is we're trying to deal with Anthropocene angst. So the Anthropocene is what people call this geological epoch. It's the first geological period named after a species, Anthropos, humans. So, you know, we had the dinosaur period and the Jurassic period and all that kind of stuff. And we're now in what people call the Anthropocene. So we're trying to deal with human-created geological time with neurons that haven't evolved much in 100,000 years since we were hunter-gatherers picking some berries, painting some caves with our hands. And so that's really why this is so important, because unless we, I believe, have quite a massive upgrade in our inner consciousness, we won't be able to affect the material world in the way we need to stop billions dying, potentially all of us dying.
Yeah, it does seem that you know, we're on a very precarious trajectory. You know, I mean, it seems like we're certainly heading into territory that we've not seen before, and you know, and the consequences. You know, it seems that some people really have a challenge looking at the long term. I mean, we're just so indoctrinated to short term, immediate response kinds of way of living that the long term perspective seems to have gotten completely lost.
Right. And so both our politics and our consumerist culture are focused on, you know, what's my next iPhone I'm going to get for Christmas? And I include myself in this characterization. I was looking myself today at upgrading. And, you know, what's going to happen with Brexit and what's going to happen in the midterms and what's going to happen in two, you know, we're very short-sighted. We're very myopic at the moment. And we've kind of been taught to be, right? The 24-hour news cycle. You know, 1 minute, the burning fires in NoCal and SoCal are like on every single news thing, and literally I haven't seen anything for 5 days. Like it never happened.
Right.
Because we've moved on. And so this speed and myopia is causing us to literally navel gaze while Rome, you know, it's like, you know, we're worrying about retiling the bathroom while Rome burns. And it's just, it's, I mean, you know, in, if we ever have a historian looking back, and they'll be like, guys, what were you doing? You know, we were worried about the wrong stuff. And so one of my strongest beliefs is that spiritual practice, psychological healing, psychological transformation, changing our habits, what you could collectively call inner work, mm-hmm. the changing of our inner dimensions, cultivating mindfulness and compassion, that is just the essential elements of changing the world. And we need to change the world right now. We need to change our systems. We need to change how business works. We need to change how politics works. We need to change how education works. And we need to do it really quickly. But we can't do it in the old ways of just changing the curriculum or just changing political party or just changing, you know, we've tried all that stuff. We spent the 20th century is essentially a history of trying to change material life without changing inner life.
Yeah.
And as you know, the communists found out, you can put people in a gulag and they don't change their thoughts. So
yeah, very much. So, you know, and speaking of business leaders and politicians, it seems that, you know, the major focus is power and profit. You know, that it's that materialistic acquisition, you know, versus that, you know, compassionate, you know, kind of understanding that is necessary to, you know, to kind of shift into, you know, save ourselves kind of mode.
Yeah. I mean, I had an experience recently. I went lucky enough to travel to Greece with my wife without the kids, just for a couple of days. And I had a profound, I guess, a spiritual experience of some sort, but it became very intellectual as well. And I realized that this dual nature of profit and power, whilst you've also got these other emotional, spiritual values, they are both important. I'm not going to say that it's not important to be good at your job and to work hard. You know, I'm an entrepreneur, you're an entrepreneur, you know, we succeed by how much we put in. But at the same time, if we only do that, we start to lose something much more valuable or equally valuable. And for me, underneath this idea of product power and profit is this sense that everything has to be productive in the way machines are productive. You know, we don't want any downtime at the factory. We don't want any downtime. So we're going to work on the commute home, and we're going to then build something at home with our kids, and then we're going to go back to work and to be more productive. And all the while, we're forgetting that there's another part of us, the consciousness part. This is why we're back to that dual aspect philosophy, spiritual atheism. So the atheism part is all about productivity and getting stuff done. That's great. But if we forget that we also just need to be present to ourselves, to nature, to each other, to our kids, to our loved ones, and it's not productive. So when I go for a walk in the middle of a working day, or I spend 10 minutes with my kid, I'm not making anything happen at that time. But it doesn't mean it's not as valuable as the time I'm making something happen. And that's where spirituality has to transform us, because until politicians and business leaders realize that there's something more than Twitter followers and there's something more than that fame and fortune stuff, we won't get the leaders we need to take us through this digital age. And I think we need extraordinary leaders to help us deal with the terror we all have, and not to go back into tribal warfare, which is what's happening at the moment, whether Republican and Democrat, whether social justice warrior or alt-right warrior. We've got to stop that tribal warfare, because we've got to focus instead on all the stuff that's coming to us as a species. And if we don't, well, you know, the asteroid will hit while we're squabbling over whether we should have gender-fluid bathrooms.
Right. And when that hits, then all of the other questions go away. I mean, there's no
need. Yes, exactly. Without the ecosystem, ecology, there is no economy. You know, without that nature, doesn't matter whose bathroom does what.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So we're down toward the end of the show here, Nick. So what is your hope or your desire? What do you think that people would take away from reading your book, Spiritual Atheist? What is it you hope that they kind of maybe embrace?
So I guess it depends where you're coming from. If you're coming from a religious point of view, then hopefully it will help you understand how you can bring science and reason and data into that religious worldview, and maybe refresh your religiosity with more of the core spiritual experience at the heart of all religion. If you come from an atheist view or a kind of cynical, skeptical view, then hopefully it will open you up to something really powerful, which does not need you to throw up your job and go and live in a commune. You don't have to have lotus flowers on your T-shirts. You don't need to do anything of that stuff. So I don't do any of that stuff, and I have an extraordinarily rich spiritual life. But wherever you come from, what I really hope is it gives you some rigorous architecture to start building something in your life that will help you be part of this transformation that we need in our world. And we can't really be part of the transformation in the world until we've healed enough of our own pain so that we have more resources within. You know, I have a saying that it's only with a healed heart can we truly step up as transformational leaders. So I'm hoping that the book can take you on a journey of your own transformation and then bring you into a powerful place to find purpose and act with it. Because it needs all of us. It really does. There's, the world's so complex and there's so many communities in it. We all have to take our own community on this journey.
Yeah, and, you know, and you know, part of the book is to recognize this, that, you know, as individuals, we do have the power and responsibility to, you know, contribute and make those changes and not rely on governments, organizations, or others to make that a reality.
Absolutely. We yeah.
Well, Nick, thank you for your time. I knew this was going to be a great conversation after reading your book. So I really want to thank
through
you.
Through many different parts of the world. And it's, yeah, I love talking about some of these things that have happened before the book and actually after the book. Books are very generative things when you write them. And they've opened up, this particular book has opened up a lot of thoughts that aren't actually in the book that we've talked about today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it and look forward to keeping in touch and seeing what happens next in your journey.
Likewise.
All right, thank you. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Nick Jenkel, and we have been talking about his book, Spiritual Atheist, Quest to Unite Science and Wisdom into a Radical New Life Philosophy to Thrive in the Digital Age. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is switchonnow.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me, that's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.